Because we know, and Bernie Sanders knows, he could be elected president tomorrow. And if we don't have a mass movement on the ground to actually force the Congress that is full of millionaires, that is full of people who have gotten fat and lazy on the status quo, if we don't have a mass movement to force them to listen to us and to implement new policies that actually will improve the quality of life for people on the ground, it won't happen. And so this is a critical intervention that Sanders is making.
And we thank you so much for being with us. We're going to do part two about 5 years after Black Lives Matter, Kianga Yamata Taylor, her new book, Race for Profit. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
And it's 5 o'clock at KBOO Portland. Coming up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Portland Latin American Film Festival at the Hollywood Theater. The next film in the series, Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, is showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. Dia de los Muertos follows Salma, a 16-year-old orphan who has never met her biological parents. Salma has spent most of her life searching out clues for her parents' identity. One day, she discovers a specific book and sets off on an adventure with her foster brothers to find the missing links to her family's heritage. Again, that's Day of the Dead, Dia de los Muertos, showing Sunday, October 27th at 2 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is having our annual book and record sale on November 23, 2019 to raise funds with support from the Willamette Week Give Guide. The sale will be located at Lagunitas Portland Community Room at 237 Northeast Broadway from 12 p.m. until 9 p.m. From classic books to coffee table books to cookbooks, treasures will be waiting for your discovery and just in time for the holidays. Enjoy community music, activities, and a live broadcast from KBOO at the event. Proceeds from the sales will support the station's operations. Right now, KBOO is accepting used books and records in good condition. Now through Friday, November 15th, listeners, members, and supporters can drop off donations during business hours at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. After hours, appointments can be made available. For more information, please call 503-231-8032 or go online to kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland man will be the first person convicted under Oregon's new bias crime law.
Two members of the far-right group, the Proud Boys, were sentenced to 4 years in prison.
And in environmental news, the city of Portland has rejected Zenith Energy's pipeline expansion proposal.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 22nd, 2019. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Althea Billings. The parents of Owen Klinger believe that a body found in Northwest Portland belongs to their son. Police discovered the body in the water near St. John's Bridge on Sunday. Owen was a freshman at University of Portland and went missing October 6th. He was last seen leaving his dorm that Sunday night. Video footage captured a man believed to be Owen walking towards St. John's later that evening. Hundreds of family, friends, and volunteers helped in the search for Owen after he went missing. Multiple searches were held throughout Portland, and a vigil was held on October 10th at University of Portland. Police are reportedly still involved and have not reported a cause of death. The Multnomah County Medical Examiner's Office is expected to issue a statement confirming Owen's death. A mass was held yesterday at the University of Portland for Owen. His mother spoke after the mass, stating, quote, "Owen was such a beautiful, beautiful soul. We are all blessed by the chance we had to know him." She also thanked the volunteers, stating, quote, "We cannot thank you enough."
The Portland man who shouted slurs at two gay men and injured one will be the first person convicted under Oregon's new bias crime law. Last month, 50-year-old Don Kirchhoff approached two gay men sitting on a bench outside of a bakery in northwest Portland and started yelling racist and homophobic slurs at them. One of the men stood up to try and quell Kirchhoff's anger, and the second man tried to de-escalate the situation by stepping in between his friend and Kirchhoff. Kirchhoff then shoved the second man into a brick wall, resulting in an injury to the victim's head and neck. When the two men started to walk away, Kirchhoff followed them and punched one of the men. Although he originally admitted to starting the physical confrontation and using the slurs, he later changed his plea and pleaded guilty to just one count of bias crime in the first degree. Kirchhoff faces 15 days in jail and 36 months probation.
The city of Portland will pay $10,000 to settle a lawsuit filed by a woman who alleged police assaulted her during a protest. Patricia Barger said police struck her twice with a baton without warning while she was watching a demonstration in October of 2016. According to the Oregonian, Barger was walking to catch a MAX train when she stopped across from City Hall to watch a demonstration. She says an officer suddenly struck her twice with a baton, first in the chest and then on the forearm, without warning. At the time, officers in riot gear were forcibly clearing demonstrators from the street who were protesting a closed-door city council vote on the police union contract. But Barger says she was not in the street, rather on the sidewalk across from City Hall when she was hit. Barger sued the city for battery in Multnomah County Circuit Court and sought $10,000 in damages for compensation. The city did not admit liability, and the settlement will go before city council for a vote on Wednesday.
Oregon Secretary of State Bev Clarno has rejected a ballot proposal that would limit undocumented immigrants' ability to get driver's licenses. Opponents of a new law that grants Oregon driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants have been working for months to repeal the policy. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Clarno announced that the effort, Initiative Petition 43, did not pass constitutional muster and cannot proceed. According to Clarno, the reason is that the wording of the petition does not include the full text of the proposed law, as required by the Oregon Constitution. Instead, the initiative petition calls for a law passed via House Bill 2015 to be repealed without offering the specific language of the change being proposed. And it's not just Clarno raising concerns about the proposal. In ballot language for the petition, the Oregon Department of Justice wrote it was unclear whether the outcome of passing the measure would actually repeal the driver's license law. House Bill 2015 was one of the most hotly contested bills Oregon lawmakers passed this year. It eliminated the requirement that a person provide legal proof of residence in order to get a state driver's license. The bill was fiercely debated in part because Oregon voters had widely rejected a similar law in 2014.
Two members of the far-right group the Proud Boys were each sentenced to 4 years in prison by a state Supreme Court judge in Manhattan. The defendants, Maxwell Hare and John Kinsman, were among 10 men who prosecutors said attacked 4 people protesting a speech at the Metropolitan Republican Club by the Proud Boys founder, Gavin McInnes. In the sentencing, Justice Mark Dwyer said the punishment was meant in part to deter others who seek to turn political differences into partisan street brawls. The incident, which took place on October 12th of last year, was seen by many as mirroring similar clashes in places like Charlottesville, Berkeley, and even Portland. The violence was captured in photographs and video recordings, generating outrage and prompting condemnation from Mayor Bill de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo. Both defendants apologized for their actions in court and were convicted of attempted gang assault, attempted assault, and riot. 7 others charged in the incident pled guilty. Justice Dwyer seemed to lay some of the blame for the violence on McInnes, the Proud Boys' founder, although he did not mention him by name. The justice said, quote, "It's a shame when some people jump up and down on a platform and their followers, their soldiers, get in trouble."
A class action lawsuit has been filed against Safeway, accusing the grocery store of charging customers a 1% fee to pay the tax to pay for a tax the city of Portland is charging large retailers to help fund its clean energy initiative. The tax was implemented on January 1st of this year and applies to large retailers with a gross income from retail sales of $1 billion or more in the U.S. and at least $500,000 in the city of Portland. This is the second class action lawsuit filed against a Portland business for passing the city tax on to customers. The first was filed against AT&T over a 5-cent billing surcharge. The plaintiff named in this lawsuit, Joshua Gagnier, visited the Safeway at 2527 Southeast 112th Avenue on October 18th and purchased a bottle of wine. The listed price on the shelf was $3.33, but when Gagnier looked at the receipt, he noticed a 3-cent surcharge. His attorney, Michael Fuller, who was also organizing the AT&T class action lawsuit, said Safeway violated the Oregon Unlawful Trade Practices Act because, quote, the surcharge was not disclosed to the customer in the advertised price of the wine he purchased.
For the second time this month, former President Jimmy Carter has been hurt in a fall. Monday night, President Carter fell in his home in Plains, Georgia, suffering a minor pelvic fracture. The 95-year-old Carter received a black eye and 17 stitches earlier this month, after which he and his wife Rosalind returned to their work building homes for Habitat for Humanity. Carter has been admitted to the Phoebe Sumter Medical Center, where he is said to be in good spirits. The former president had also fallen last spring, which resulted in a hip replacement surgery. In 2015, Carter was diagnosed with brain cancer, which he survived, responding well to treatment. At 95, Carter is the oldest living former president, and he and wife Rosalyn recently celebrated their 73rd wedding anniversary, making them the longest wedded first couple.
Advocates are criticizing Florida's newly refiled parental consent abortion bill. Leading medical groups, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics, all oppose such consent laws. Trimmel Gomes has more.
Youth advocates are planning to hold a press conference and rally in Florida's capital today to speak out against a parental consent abortion bill that's on fast track through the Republican-controlled legislature. Currently, Florida law requires parental notification if a minor is planning an abortion, but under House Bill 265, revived by Republican Representative Aaron Grawl of Vero Beach, they will be forced to provide consent. The bill is scheduled for just one stop in the House Health and Human Services Committee before it gets a full floor vote. Democratic Representative Anna Escamani of Orlando says she will stand with youths outside of the committee so they can be heard.
Centering on the voices of young people who would be directly impacted by this type of legislation, but also painting the picture how this is not really about parental consent. This is about attempting to go to the new Florida Supreme Court to ban abortion overall.
Grau argues parents have a fundamental right in the upbringing of their children. Back in April, the House voted 69-44 to approve a similar bill, but the Senate version stalled in committee. Escamani says she thinks her Republican colleagues are pushing a slew of abortion bills to take advantage of the new conservative majority in the Florida Supreme Court.
The intention of my colleagues in the Florida legislature is to pass another abortion restriction that can test the courts, which have been completely pushed towards the right with the new appointees by Governor Ron DeSantis.
A previous law was ruled unconstitutional in 1989 by the Florida Supreme Court over concern for privacy rights. For Public News Service, I'm Trimmel Gomes.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6, it's Preference. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's will also be partly cloudy with a high of 63 degrees. Today in history, in 1968, Apollo 7, the first human spaceflight mission carried out by the U.S., splashed down safely in the Atlantic Ocean. It was the first mission in the U.S.'s Apollo program to carry a crew into space. And in the 10-day duration of the mission, Apollo 7 orbited the Earth 163 times. The quote of the day is from Neil Armstrong, who said of the Apollo missions, quote, "The important achievement of Apollo was demonstrating that humanity is not forever chained to this planet, and our visions to go rather further than that, and our opportunities are unlimited."
A new report from the United Nations highlights poor housing conditions for indigenous people, and a South Dakota drug law affects Native Americans more than any other demographic. With that story and more, it's National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new report from the United Nations calls housing conditions abhorrent for Indigenous people in Canada and around the world. The Globe and Mail reports UN Special Rapporteur Lilani Farha says Indigenous people are more likely to suffer inadequate housing, which leads to poor health outcomes. They're also vulnerable to forced evictions, land grabs, and the effects of climate change. She said housing problems also exacerbate the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Farha said housing shortages in northern Canada force some Indigenous people to sleep in shifts. The document also notes 75% of reserves have contaminated water, and in urban areas, Indigenous people often face racism from landlords. Farha said one of the goals of the report was to link the UN's Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People to the UN's legislation on the right to adequate housing. She added Indigenous people, especially Indigenous women, should be involved in efforts to address housing shortages. South Dakota's ingestion law affects Native Americans more than any other demographic in the state. That's according to data from the Unified Judicial System in cases where ingestion is the highest charged crime. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports.
South Dakota is the only state in the country where ingestion of a controlled substance can be charged as a felony-level offense. In the eight other states in the U.S. where ingestion is a charge, it's either a misdemeanor or felony probation. In about 10% of cases, prosecutors use ingestion as a bargaining chip. The defendant ultimately pleads guilty to ingestion, and other charges are dismissed. According to statistics from the state, as of September 30th of 2019, approximately 10% of Native men sit in prison for ingestion, as opposed to 6% for non-Native men. As for women, approximately 23% of female Native American inmates are in prison for ingestion. Non-Native females make up just over 16%. Candy Brings Plenty is the Indigenous justice organizer for the ACLU in the Dakotas. She says the ingestion data doesn't represent the whole scope of the issue. Brings Plenty says there's evident racial disparity.
Poverty and the high prevalence of alcohol abuse definitely plays a role, but it's also the police patterns, profiling the women, just, you know, even just racial profiling, the racism itself that continues to contribute to what that looks like. You know, for the terms of ingestion, I know that, you know, drug and alcohol related offenses are definitely targeted towards Native Americans.
South Dakota lawmakers meet this week to discuss the state's controlled substances laws. It's their third such meeting, and they will decide what steps to take next. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
The Yakima Nation and the states of Oregon and Washington want the federal government to declare a new Superfund site on an island near Bonneville Dam on the Columbia River. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports Bradford Island was used by the federal government as a dump. It's full of toxins, including polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, and people are advised not to eat fish from the area. Tribal officials and environmental groups say there have been delays in cleaning up the island, and that's posing a serious threat to human health and the environment. A spokesman with EPA says the agency is considering the request. Under the Superfund program, there must be a rulemaking process with public input. OPB reports a determination on the island's priority status would likely be made by 2021. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
The City of Portland rejected Zenith Energy's pipeline expansion at their Northwest Portland oil terminal. The city cited their 2016 policy that opposes building additional fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland or adjacent waterways. The company stated in their permit that the pipelines would be used to carry biofuels and a chemical used to make polyurethane. They said they had no plans to use the pipelines for fossil fuels, though they admitted in their application that the pipelines were capable of carrying fossil fuels. The company began shipping tar sands crude oil through the terminal in 2017. They have been working to expand their shipping capacity through Portland as part of a larger project to get tar sands oil to market. Community groups have been organizing to shut down any expansion of fossil fuel infrastructure in Portland. They point out that tar sands oil is a major greenhouse gas contributor, Transporting oil poses high risks for communities, especially in Portland, where there is a risk of earthquakes or oil spills.
The Trump administration is trying to weaken protections for a threatened fish in California. The change would allow large quantities of water to be diverted from the San Francisco Bay Delta to irrigate dry farmland. This could immensely harm the region's fragile ecosystem, including the threatened fish, the Delta smelt. The plan is a large victory for a wealthy group of California farmers that lobbied to weaken protections on the fish. This move also raises ethics questions about Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, who was the lobbyist for those wealthy farmers until just months before he joined the Trump administration. Federal investigators are looking into whether Bernhardt's efforts at the Interior Department to weaken protections violated revolving door rules designed to prevent former lobbyists from helping pass clients from within the government. Investigators are also looking into whether he improperly continued lobbying for those farmers even after he deregistered as a lobbyist before joining the current administration. The Delta smelt was granted Endangered Species Act protections a decade ago, along with certain types of West Coast salmon. The new biological opinion released jointly by the Interior Department and the Commerce Department reverses these findings. The protections ensured that the California rivers and bays in which the fish swim would get preference over irrigation systems in times of drought. Multiple scientific reports have concluded that diverting those waters could threaten water birds and killer whales, harm commercial fisheries, and promote toxic algae blooms. Administration officials expect the plan to be finalized in January. Once implemented, the change would allow water to be diverted from fish to farms by the spring of 2020.
San Francisco is banning private vehicles from its downtown Market Street. The Municipal Transport Agency voted unanimously this week on the road closure. Market Street is one of the busiest streets in San Francisco. Around 500,000 pedestrians and 650 cyclists use this street during peak commuter hours. Under the new ordinance, Market will only be open to public transportation, pedestrians, and cyclists. Taxis and buses will continue to use the street, while Uber and Lyft will be banned. The initiative also includes a $600 million street renovation, which will build park benches, bike racks, and wider bike lanes. There were 123 injuries caused by collisions on Market last year alone. Market is cited as one of the highest areas for fatal collisions in San Francisco. San Francisco Mayor London Breed supports the project, stating, quote, "Market Street is at the heart of our city, and we need to do everything we can to make it a safer, more livable, and more vibrant place for our residents, workers, and visitors," end quote. The vehicle ban is expected to begin on Market Street sometime next year.
Does civilization really mean progress? That's the question that author Chris Ryan tackles in his new book, Civilized to Death. Ryan previously wrote the best-selling book, Sex at Dawn, back in 2010. And in his new work, he argues that the way forward may be a look backward. KBOO's Paul Rowland sat down with Ryan to learn more about this new project.
I'm speaking with Christopher Ryan, the author of New York Times bestseller Sex at Dawn, which came out in 2010 and created a lot of buzz and some controversy, and also the just published Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. He'll be speaking this evening at Powell's City of Books on Burnside at 7:30. Welcome to KBOO, Chris.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So let's just dive right in. So what would you say your goal in writing your new book was?
Well, I guess the overriding goal is to give people the information they need to make a more informed cost-benefit analysis of the value of civilization. In other words, we're inundated with propaganda telling us that civilization is this amazing benefit to humanity, it's the greatest thing any species has ever done, etc. And the flip side of that is that we're inundated with propaganda telling us that life before the state was horrible. Nature red in tooth and claw, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, and all the rest of that. Turns out that's all wrong. Life before the state was not solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, or short. And the benefits of civilization, such as they are generally partial fixes for problems that were caused by civilization itself. So I wanted to try to clarify exactly what civilization has brought to us, what it's cost us, so that people can make a more informed decision as to why they might feel uncomfortable, even if they appear to be winning the game.
So I guess you need to kind of clarify or define what you mean by civilization.
Yeah, well, that's the first part of the book, is really getting into that. Civilization refers to the sort of radical changes in the way people started to live immediately or shortly after the advent of agriculture, which at its earliest was about 10,000 years ago. It's important to understand that anatomically modern human beings, people who look like us, if they walk down the street dressed in contemporary clothing, you wouldn't notice any difference. They have been on Earth for about 300,000 years. So 10,000 years at the earliest, more like 4,000 or 5,000 in most cases, of civilized, settled, hierarchical living is a very small fragment of our total time as human beings. So in order to understand human nature and human behavior and the things that make us happy and anxious, it's important to look at those 300,000 years of human existence to get a real sense for what humans are like. It's like if you want to understand a dog, you study wolves. We're domesticated humans at this point.
So give us to use a kind of unfortunate civilized metaphor, so give us your elevator pitch or talk or whatever for how that came about. I know it's an immensely long story, and you know there's been massive volumes of
yeah.
But how do we get not to like here in 2019, but how did civilization come about?
You know, civilization, or to simplify it a little, agriculture, which is the necessary precondition for civilization, arose in different parts of the world at different times. The earliest is in the Fertile Crescent, as I said, about 10,000 years ago, but it also arose independently in southern China, in Cambodia, in the Andes, in Mexico. And essentially, the same conditions existed. Scientists can now see that the same conditions anticipated the rise of civilization in each of these cases. And what that looks like is an increase in resources. So unusually constant rains, a lot of food, the animal populations increased, the more fruiting trees, more food all over, across the board. And then there was a sudden decline, a sudden reduction in rainfall and famine. And so in previous cases, what would have happened is human population would have been reduced through starvation, as it is with all animals. But in these cases, someone figured out how to get around this sudden reduction in food by digging a trench, let's say, from a river to a grove of fruiting trees and keeping them alive. Once that step was taken, it's a ratcheting process that sets in, because the population levels then continue to grow very rapidly. And once you have surplus food, then all sorts of other things kick in, like political hierarchies, women lose their status relative to men, domesticated animals come on the scene, and you have a different relationship between human beings and the natural world, where our ancestors were then trying to control the world rather than adapt to it. And this is a radical change in human behavior and experience.
That was KABU's Paul Roland in conversation with author Chris Ryan about his new book, Civilized to Death. Ryan will be at Powell's this evening at 7:30, diving deeper into the meaning of progress and how, in order to move forward, we need to look backward. An extended version of this interview can be heard tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. on KABU on Wednesday Talk Radio.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, October 22nd, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, Annie Maher, Paul Roland, and Kevin Dugan. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Ted Jones. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up next is Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a bi-weekly look at the intersection of people and policing in Portland. One of the beautiful things about volunteer community radio is that everything can fall apart right at the last minute. And when it does, there are always options. Long story short, that's what happened to us this week, and so we've dug down almost 50 years in the KBOO archives for a glimpse into local politics and police behavior in Portland's Albina neighborhood. Who Are the Panthers was produced by KBOO volunteers in the summer and fall of 1970 and is presented by Albert Schwartz. Portland's black population was redlined into the Albina area by racist real estate practices and city policy in the years following World War II and the displacement of people after the 1948 Vanport flood. Official neglect left the neighborhood to fend for itself over the following decades. In 1970, Albina was centered around Lower Williams Avenue and Northeast Union Avenue, later renamed Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. The Portland chapter of the Black Panthers had formed about a year before this was recorded, in the summer of 1969. That summer also saw several days of disturbances in the neighborhood following a confrontation between police and a crowd of 150 young people at a diner at Union and Shaver. The unrest and a wave of arson that followed brought little sympathy from city leaders and increased scrutiny by the police bureau. By October 1970, around 30% of the businesses that once lined Albina's main streets had left. Citizens in Albina had little choice in the fate of their neighborhood. In 1972, not long after this piece aired, Emmanuel Hospital's expansion would completely destroy a large part of Albina's heart at the intersection of Williams and Russell and the blocks to the north. This was the last of a series of devastating urban renewal programs, which also included Memorial Coliseum and I-5. Who Are the Panthers contains the voices of Panther co-founder Kent Ford, police officers assigned to the area, and numerous residents of Albina. It is a historical document, but also a snapshot of a neighborhood in crisis, reeling from immediate injustices like the shooting and arrest of a young black man by police, crackdowns on social programs, and ongoing disinvestment in the area. This piece contains material that may upset some listeners, including discussion of racism and police violence. The attitudes expressed and language used by police officers and some other voices in this piece range from old-fashioned to insensitive to racist to actually prohibited by the FCC in one case. Thank you for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. Again, this is a documentary produced by KBOO volunteers in 1970. Who Are the Panthers?
Portland, Oregon sprawls pleasantly between green hillsides along two rivers. About 1 million people live in or near it. About 20,000 of those people are black. Most of them live in a gently declining 19th century neighborhood called Albina, near the center of the metropolitan area. Samuel Johnson is a minister in Albina.
I laid in my bed last night and wrestled with myself concerning whether black people are going to stand up like men and take over that community, clean this community up, and make it something to be proud of, or whether we're going to continue to play around with the city structure, whether they don't give a damn about black people. Prostitution is walking all over this community. Gambling is going on the street. Selling dope is all over the area. And nobody's doing nothing about it, but yet they will come in here and start a riot over a kid taking a pair of socks out of a store.
Police Bureau Captain William Taylor's men patrol about half of Albina. They've had a number of clashes with the Black Panther Party.
If they would be kind enough to give you a roster of their membership, you could very well check and find it. Almost all of them are thieves of one type or another. When I say thief, I don't mean a chance or occasional thief. I mean, a guy that's got a record long enough to where you're pretty sure that this is his way of life, that he's chosen. He's chosen it to be a thief.
Kent Ford is a Black Panther captain and the head of the party in Portland.
But you see, we in the black community, we have enemies, and nobody can never make us forget the enemies, which is the three enemies of the black community, which these greedy, avaricious dogs who exploit the black community every day. Then you got these racist pigs, the kind that shot Albert and the kind of brutalizing and murdering black people every day, occupying the black community.
Can I say something?
When I finish, partner, when I finish. Then you got these racist judges who sits on the bench and try to administer injustice out to people. And I'm not trying to exclude Albert's judge because he got about one of the most racist and low-life judges I know of.
Many young men inhabit the streets of Albina. This is one of them. He is not a member of the party.
Do you know any people in the Black Panther Party?
Do I know any? I think I know them all. They're my brothers. They're my brothers. And the ones that's not are still my brothers, but they don't realize it. You know? Yeah, I know them all.
Who Are the Panthers was produced by KBOO-FM during the summer and early fall of 1970. This is Albert Schwartz.
We've had a number of occasions where we've been at cross purposes with the Black Panthers, and probably will continue as long as they have an organization. They're militantly anti-police. Well, they're militantly anti-establishment or anti-government, or as we know the government anyhow, and influenced quite heavily with quite left-wing, or
it must have been about 68, I think it was. Late 68 or so. And, you know, we had internal difficulties and stuff like that. So we just decided, you know, just made it the whole classes and, you know, just followed our ideology and stuff. Which later on, you know, when it started, sort of wrenching it out and trying to reach a broad section of the community, we ran into sort of difficulties, you know, because of sort of the way we got started, you know. You know, there was a lot of confusion, you know, whether we really should start above ground or underground, you know. And so we decided, you know, we just let everybody know about it, and whoever wanted to join, they join, you know. And basically, that's, you know, that's about how it really began.
The police and the Panthers are at odds in Portland as elsewhere. The issue is control of Albina, whether it will be exercised by the police, the representatives of the unresponsive City Hall regime, or by the black people who live there.
Albina gets precisely, according to all of our statistics, everything we got, precisely no more and no less of the car coverage that the other districts do, with the sole exception that all districts in Albina are two-man cars, the rest of them may be one-man cars.
Illegal pleasures can be readily found at the corner of Williams and Russell, the most central point in the diffuse neighborhood. Whites own the property in which these pleasures are consummated. Whites bring in the drugs that are sold on the streets and in the parks.
Drugs, you know, is all part of that a thing that keeps people enslaved, you know, physically and mentally and everything. It's just, it's what, you know, all parts of what kills or oppressed people. And people have to resort to drugs, you know, I guess to cope with the conditions. But that's not the answer.
From the rules of the Black Panther Party, any member found shooting narcotics will be expelled from this party.
Most of the people that we have living in the Albina community are fine, law-abiding, upstanding citizens, and most of them, contrary to popular belief, work for a living. A lot of people think that, hell, everybody in Albina is on some kind of dole, and that's not true at all. Most of them work for a living. They pay taxes just like you and I. They're concerned with the same damn things you and I are. They're concerned about the kind of education their kid's getting, what kind of associates he runs around with, whether or not he gets into trouble, whether or not he can afford a new television set or a better car that's not going to break down. It's just the same thing. When he gets done working at night, generally speaking, he'd just as soon go home and open a can of beer and sit in front of television. He hasn't got time to run down to these meetings and start yelling and screaming against the establishment or and that sort of thing.
Albina is pleasant, alongside Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, New York, or the Fillmore District in San Francisco. There's little access to medical care, public transportation is sparse, a couple of weekly newspapers are the only black-controlled media. Portland's five television stations have almost completely ignored Portland's black citizens, except when there is a sensation to be had. A Black Panther member talks about television coverage.
And like they follow us around to stores, you know, like they were really covering us. They're covering us from the minute we left the office to the way to the church, and from the church out to get donations, you know, and they wanted to come in the room, and like they just were really all for the party and our program, you know. And they, you know, by the time it got on TV, it didn't look that way at all.
Firebombings have been common. A bakery at the edge of Albina burned during the spring of 1970. A young black man, not a member of the party, is being held. His name is Nathaniel Fennell. He demanded and was given a lie detector test. The police bureau calls the test results inconclusive.
I see that Kent Ford just last week, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, was arrested by one of our black officers in East Precinct, Tony Newman. He called him, what was it? Some name like called him a black a few other things. And so Newman sort of resented this, particularly since Ford was yelling at the top of his voice right out in public and told him to knock it off, and he didn't, so he arrested him for disorderly conduct.
Yeah, well, see what happened. We had just left the health clinic and was going around to the dental clinic. And I had my wife's two little kids in the car, plus our sister, RV, and Charles. We went to the service station to get some gas. At this time, Tony Newman turned the corner and he gave me the finger. First he gave me the peace sign, then he gave me the finger. Then he squeezed down in the seat like this, and then he said, that was a nice job you did on Grandma Cookie. So I plugged up my ears, just like this. In the process of me plugging up my ears, I asked Charles, I said, Charles, what did he say? He said, that was a nice job you did on Grandma Cookie. I said, don't say nothing, don't say nothing. He's not supposed to say that. And so, I covered up my ears just like this, and I was getting ready to get in the car, and he ran over to the car. And then he grabbed me by the arm and said, disorderly conduct. So I said, well, put the handcuffs on and take me on to jail. Then his friend, Craig, Officer Craig, told him on the way downtown that he shouldn't have indicted me because he shouldn't have taken me downtown, you know, because, you know, that it was wrong. And he says, well, I'm going to do it anyway.
And that was all there was to it?
That's all there was to it. And I got downtown and found my bill was
$1,000.
$1,000 for disorderly conduct. You see, basically, black people historically has suffered under humiliation and, you know, just plain fascist attacks, you know, and, you know, with lynchings and stuff like this, and they've been scared to defend themselves, you know, and they have guns and they're used against each other and they're, you know, stuff like that. When it comes to, you know, using them against the people that's actually killing you, you know, they're afraid to. But this is why the modern main influence related to black people do have the right, you know, to bear arms, you know, just for self-defense. And not to go out and even Malcolm's saying, you know, everybody can, you know, use rights of self-defense, but, you know, not advocating guns to go out and kill anybody or white people, nothing like that, but you just use guns to defend yourselves.
So this is why, this is emphasized. So there's really an emphasis in the newspaper, for instance, drawings and.
There's an emphasis. You see, why it has to be done that way, you know, is to get it in black people's heads. You know, here in Babylon, you know, you need a gun, you know, and so to see the man tries to get you away from guns. You know, he wants you to use guns abroad, you know, to fight everybody else. But, you know, you can't use guns here at home in the black community, you know, where you're actually being hunted down and killed.
Albert Williams, a young black man, not a member of the party, picked up a gun after being chased to the party headquarters during February 1970.
And, of course, a few months ago, we had occasion to arrest a young man in the Black Panther headquarters who was wanted on a warrant issued by the court. And, well, we made a great issue out of this. You know, it was a misdemeanor warrant. Of course, it wasn't pointed out at the time that this kid was just a thief. That's all. He was on probation from a burglary charge. He was wanted on this particular warrant and wanted on another warrant for non-appearance in court. And later he did have his burglary parole revoked as a result of his subsequent thing. Not only that, but he tried to kill a policeman. When they tried to take him prisoner, he was given every opportunity to come out of that place, and his response was to take a Enfield rifle and try to shoot Officer Stan Harmon, who, thank God, didn't get hit, and pulled his gun at the same time and returned the fire and did hit this kid.
What did actually happen down there?
Well, at the courthouse?
No, at the headquarters.
That's what actually happened. That's the truth. I mean, the truth of the whole scene right there. Harmon shot from the inside. Albert put the gun down, and Harmon ran from a doorway and jumped on the desk and shot up at Albert. The point blew out from here to right there. Then he ran outside, and then the rest of the pigs ran up there and got Albert and dragged him all the way down and threw him in the back seat and hauled him to one hospital. Then they couldn't have the facilities to take care of that type of wound, then they hauled him to another hospital. But they didn't take him to the closest one right over here. They took him way up to Dollar County. And so that's the truth of actually what went down.
Emmanuel's only 5 or 6 blocks from
here. Yeah, they claim they couldn't want to take a nap because it was fearful demonstrations. But what they were trying to do, the act was so deliberately and you know, inhuman that they deliberately did this, you know, to try to get some kind of lie to feed to the people.
Although Albert Williams was not a Panther, the party supported him with a demonstration when he came to trial.
He only gonna have one chance. And his chances right now, as it looks, is slim and none. Because he's black, and it's absolutely impossible for a black man to get a fair trial in America today.
Right on.
And everybody knows that, so there's no sense in us fooling ourselves. So you from the white community, you're on trial also. Because if you fail to show up and show your support for Albert, well, then we know what's going to have to happen. The same way with the trial of Bobby Sears, and not only Bobby Sears, but the other Panthers who are in jail right now. So it's up to you to find out that black people can get justice in the courts of America. It's absolutely impossible. So for the rest of this trial, we're not going to be jiving. So there's no sense in us trying to fool ourselves. Whenever a black man comes down here to go to trial, you know he's going to get railroaded. I don't care if he has the best lawyer in the world, and if the people don't show up and see that justice is handed down the people's way, the brother's going to get sent off to jail. Now, there's a few things that you should know that what happened this morning. Come to find out, Albert Williams has been in jail ever since February on a false indictment. And this morning, the old degenerate, wrinkle-ass grand jury met and decided they're going to re-indict him on a new charge. And so that means all the time he's dead from February to now is just dead time.
The trial ended in a mistrial.
Actually, my impression of the Black Panthers is that they're just a group of people that are almost precisely like their counterparts from the white, some of the white communities down south, particularly like the Ku Klux Klan. And I don't see any real difference between the two of them. Neither one of them believe in following the established laws of this nation or even the communities that they live in. And if they don't like it, they'll use whatever violent means are necessary to do what they want to. And they're quite racist and anti-establishment, both organizations.
So, let's see, I think it was last December we got a breakfast program started. Then we got last January, I think we got the health clinic here started. And last February we got a demo clinic started.
We usually have 1 to 2 doctors a night, plus usually 2 medical students. And 1 nurse, sometimes 2 if we're lucky, and a lab technician. And then I'm here every night, and then I have usually another volunteer receptionist with me.
Emmanuel Hospital in Albina is operated by the Lutheran Church. It is modern and expensive. Multnomah County Hospital, a public facility, is cheaper but several miles away. A patient at the Panther Clinic talks about an experience at County Hospital.
It's true, because I had 3 children up there, and I do know what it's all about. I went up there one day for a checkup. I was pregnant, and I got up there by 11 o'clock, and I didn't leave till 5:30 that evening. The janitors were sweeping up.
The party's medical and dental clinics are limited to residents of the neighborhood, not necessarily to black people. A white volunteer doctor and white volunteer nurse treat an old woman, white, with a foot injury.
Now make it all in. Now make it all in.
Good morning, it does you.
Yeah.
I think that they're a threat only in the fact that they can cause a great deal of difficulty in harassment tactics, a hit and run sort of thing. I mean, they're quite prone to do things like the fire bombings and that sort of thing, but not generally much outside of the Albina community. See, in the Albina community, they have a great deal of anonymity, so to speak. It's inconceivable to me, for instance, although you hear these scare things, and we've had Panther people hop up and talk about if the racism isn't ceased in places like Lake Oswego or some of our suburban communities, that there's going to be burning and that sort of thing. But and it's alarmed some of the people, but I think it's ridiculous on the face of it. Those guys aren't, you know, they may sound like idiots with the rhetoric that they get up and peel off once in a while, but they're not stupid enough to go out in some white community and try to take on the townspeople or anything like that. They lose at the best thing that they have, and that's anonymity, being able to fade into their surroundings. Carload of Black Panthers going out in Lake Oswego know damn good and well that the first firebomb they threw, people are going to haul out deer rifles and blow their heads off.
Young white radicals admiring the Panthers have formed a White Panther organization. A White Panther spoke at the demonstration for Albert Williams.
Dig it, they're going to come down on us. Albert was busted first. Albert was shot because he was black. They just arrest us. Sooner or later they're going to shoot us too if we don't stop it right now. Right on. They shot us at Kent State. They shot James Rector, what, years ago, year and a half ago, whatever it was. So we say right on. We say right on to the Black Panther Party. We say right on to any group that says off the pig and power to the people.
The Black Panthers, targets for the police, spokesman for a militancy that frightens middle-class whites who would otherwise ignore the black community, could not survive if the people who live in Albina were not willing to have them survive. Like Mao Zedong's guerrillas, they are like fish in friendly water in Albina. Mao Zedong's picture hangs on the wall of the medical clinic, as do the pictures of Ho Chi Minh and Malcolm X. White America has killed the nonviolent workers for black freedom. Many black Americans have apparently decided that nonviolence has accomplished nothing. The program of the Black Panther Party is called the 10-Point Platform and Program. Number one, we want freedom. We want power to determine the destiny of our black community. Number two, we want full employment for our people. Number three, we want an end to the robbery by the capitalist of our black community. Number four, we want decent housing fit for shelter of human beings. Number five, we want education for our people that exposes the true nature of this decadent American society. We want education that teaches us our true history and our role in the present-day society. Number six, we want all black men to be exempt from military service. Number seven, we want an immediate end to police brutality and murder of black people. Number eight, we want freedom for all black men held in federal, state, county, and city prisons and jails. Number nine, we want all black people, when brought to trial, to be tried in court by a jury of their peer group or people from their black communities, as defined by the Constitution of the United States. Number 10, we want land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, and peace. And as our major political objective, a United Nations supervised plebiscite to be held throughout the black colony in which only black colonial subjects will be allowed to participate for the purpose of determining the will of black people as to their national destiny. If the style of the 10 points seems alien to political logic as practiced in white America, it may be because black Americans have never been allowed to have a part in that political logic, beyond attempts at bribery with tokens of false concern.
They have a hard, tough way to go, and they're criticized and set upon in so many different ways that the average white policeman, hell, when he goes home from his job, even if he works in Albina, he can pretty well shed it, you know. But they have a lot of trouble. So, as a consequence, recruiting kids from the black community for a police officer, why should he? He's quite employable, generally speaking. If he can pass our exam, if he can meet our standards, he can go out here and get a better paying job in industry or business.
How did you yourself get into the party?
I just started attending the classes and stuff, and just stayed with it. That's all.
For me, I ain't never been in a riot. I ain't never been in none of that. But you know what? I like to, now that I see how it go down. I really would.
If they throw a rock, that's good, because if you seen the way the law beat him with a stick and it's all them lost and didn't nobody even get close to one but me. And I was in the middle trying to talk to the cat, and he just beat him upside the head with a club.
Who Are the Panthers was produced at KBOO-FM in Portland. This is Albert Schwartz.
Now, there was a white family that moved back to the black area, which a lot of young whites are doing. It was a robbery in the area. The police force come, the first thing they want to know, why are you living in this area? As if whites are not supposed to live here. So you can't tell me that they're concerned. They're not concerned. They're using and abusing the black community. And any time any policeman would trail a car from Ainsworth and Union down to a public park where you know there's masses of young blacks to make the arrest, it's poor judgment.
It's like this all over, you know. Portland, this is just some of the early stages of it. Repression or fascism, whatever you want to call it. But, you understand the party's 10-point platform and program, you know. Like, it's basically very simple. Like, I seriously doubt is Albert Williams even have a jury of his peers, you know, people from his same social, economic, and political background, which is very important. He has to have that in order to get a fair trial. Just because he's black means that he's going to get an unfair trial in the first place.
The people have got to wake up, because if you don't, you won't. Either open your eyes and now, or close them and lay down. Because you're dead and stankin' already. You either gotta see the justice or be unjustly dealt with. It's either deal with it or let it deal with you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Totality of Circumstances this week. That was a KBOO documentary which was produced by volunteers in 1970 and was hosted by Albert Schwartz. It's called Who Are the Panthers? Stay tuned in the next couple days. We will post it on our webpage at kboo.fm. Again, this is Totality of Circumstances. We're a show about people and policing in Portland. And you can catch us again in 2 weeks on November 5th at 5:30 p.m., right after the KBOO Evening News. Totality of Circumstances is produced by Jasmine Moneymaker and myself, Sam Bowman. And thank you, everybody, for listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, your community radio station.
Shout it out, I'm on yours. That bushka, that bushka, that bushka. You are listening to KBOO, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. Next up is Preference with your host, Hedda.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Get Kids Outdoors Dinner on Friday, October 25th from 6 to 9 p.m. at EcoTrust in Portland.